The following is a guest lecture by Dr. Richard Bauckham, delivered on November 14, 2007 at Westminster Seminary, California. For more information about this message or Westminster Seminary, visit us online at wscal.edu or call us at 760-480-8474. That's online at wscal.edu or call us at 760-480-8474.
Thank you very much. It's very good to be here with you this morning. Why do our New Testaments contain four Gospels, no fewer and no more? The question becomes especially interesting when we know not only that there were other Gospels that did not get into the New Testament, but also that some of those Gospels actually are available to us to read and study for ourselves. The existence of other Gospels has been an intriguing fact, guaranteed to arouse lively public interest, at least since the 1890s, when a papyrus containing what was assumed to be part of the Gospel of Peter was discovered in Egypt. Now everyone knows about other Gospels because of the quite misleading statements about them in Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. The fascination of other Gospels is not hard to appreciate. They have the appeal of the unknown, and even when seen through the lens of a conspiracy theory, as in the Da Vinci Code, the appeal of the forbidden. Suppose these other Gospels, rediscovered now after 1,600 years of oblivion, tell us what the authoritarian church that suppressed them did not want us to know. Maybe they will tell us the dangerous and embarrassing truth about Jesus that the official Gospels hushed up. And maybe the Jesus we find in these other Gospels will be altogether more congenial and appealing to us than the Jesus of the four Gospels. The danger of finding what we want in Gospels we may not actually have bothered to read is well illustrated by the Da Vinci Code, which makes the extraordinary claim that the Gnostic Gospels portray Jesus as purely human. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Gnostic Jesus was a thoroughly supernatural and divine figure, very dubiously human. However, one of the things that the other Gospels may do for us is to help us understand the four Gospels better. One New Testament scholar once said that the person who knows only the canonical Gospels does not understand them. Certainly an exaggerated claim, but the truth in it is that we can recognize the distinctive features of the four Gospels better when we see them in the context of the other Gospels that did not make it into the canon. What was it about the four that gave them the advantage over the others? What was it about the four that is common to all and marks all of them, all four of them, out from other Gospels? Does it still make sense to regard these four Gospels, in the way that virtually all Christians down the centuries have done, as accounts of Jesus that are normative for our Christian faith and practice? Well, I want to begin the argument by asking, what is a Gospel? We do need to know something about the types of literature that we're calling Gospels when we speak of other Gospels. People who've heard about other Gospels but never read them tend to assume that they must be the same sort of literature as the four Gospels in the New Testament, but not at all. In the second and third centuries, there were all sorts of Gospels, and not even their titles help us very much to know what they are like as literature. Now, many of these Gospels are those that I've been calling Gnostic Gospels, the usual description. I ought perhaps to say that I am using it in a broader sense than some scholars now think we should use it. It's difficult to find another word for the Gospels that were discovered at Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945. But I'm using the term Gnostic fairly loosely and broadly, as a convenient term for those Gospels. Now, these Gospels, these Gnostic Gospels, happen to be the other Gospels besides the four that we have in more or less complete form. But they were not the only other Gospels. Many have not survived. So I want at this point to clarify what sort of Gospels were around in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. And for the moment, I mean that in a literary sense. We'll get to theology later on. So for the moment, let's try to place our four Gospels and the Gnostic Gospels in the spectrum of types of Gospel writings that there were. First, there were narrative Gospels. The four Gospels in the New Testament are narrative Gospels that tell the story of Jesus from his birth or from the beginning of his ministry down to his appearances after the resurrection. More precisely, we could say that these are biographical Gospels, because the type of literature in their time that they most resemble is the ancient biography. Now, there were other Gospels of this type, but we unfortunately know little about them. There were several Gospels used exclusively by Jewish Christians, but we have only small fragments of them. The Gospel of Peter, which was probably of this type, we have a considerable section of the text, but still only a fragment. And there are some papyrus fragments of Gospels, we don't know what Gospels they came from, that may well have come from Gospels of this biographical type. But we can't say much more about them. None of the Gnostic Gospels, we should note, are narrative Gospels of this kind. Secondly, there are narrative Gospels of a different and rather specialized kind, known generally as the infancy Gospels, and these are Gospels, stories that supplement and expand the accounts of the birth and infancy of Jesus in the canonical Gospels. These were never really competitors with other Gospels, and I'm not going to consider those more closely today. Thirdly, we have only one example, the Gospel of Thomas, of a second kind of Gospel, a sayings Gospel. The Gospel of Thomas consists almost entirely of sayings of Jesus, presented one after the other as individual sayings. Now, the Gospel of Thomas is the most controversial of the Gnostic Gospels, and the one for which the term Gnostic is most hotly contested. But it does have a lot in common ideologically with the Gnostic Gospels, and I'm going to treat it as belonging broadly to that same category. Now, number four, the category of Gospel in which most of the Gnostic Gospels belong, as well as a few other texts, is the post-resurrection dialogue or revelation. This accounts, for example, for the Gospel of Mary, the Apocryphon of James, the Apocryphon of John, the Dialogue of the Saviour, the Sophia of Jesus Christ, the Book of Thomas, and others. You can see these texts are not always entitled Gospels, but they all do clearly belong to a common type. In all of these, the risen Christ is presented with a group of disciples, or sometimes just one favoured disciple, and they record the esoteric teaching of Jesus during that period with his disciples after the resurrection. And fifthly, there are just two Gnostic Gospels that present the same kind of special revelatory teaching given by Jesus to disciples, but in this case somewhat earlier in the period before or at the time of the crucifixion. And these are the Gospel of Judas, it's become so famous in the last year or so, and the Coptic Apocalypse of Peter, which, despite the term, is the same sort of literature. And finally, number six, there are some Gospels that are actually theological treatises, the Gospel of Truth and the Gospel of Philip, but they're not stories about Jesus at all. So those are the kinds of Gospels that we are dealing with, the sort of literature about Jesus that was going around in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So my next section is the fourfold Gospel canon. How did it come about? Now, one thing is clear. By the later 2nd century, there were lots of Gospels around, and most of them claimed to be apostolic. bearing the names not only of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but also of Thomas, Philip, James, Mary, and others. How did the mainstream church's four gospel canon emerge from that plethora of candidates for authoritative gospel status? Which meant, of course, something very important indeed. It meant the authority to define what the true Christian message was on the basis of who the real Jesus was. Now, I should, I think, at this point make clear what I mean by the term canon. I'm not concerned here at all with the other literature in the New Testament, only with the four gospel canon. One could distinguish between a collection of four gospels and a canon of four gospels. A collection wouldn't have to make those four gospels the only gospels of any value to the church. But the term canon means that there are four and only four authentic and authoritative gospels. Now, we find an unequivocal expression of that view for the first time in Irenaeus of Lyon, a great theologian writing around the end of the second century. We find Irenaeus defending the view that there are four authentic gospels, no more and no fewer, against proposals that the church should use only one gospel, as well as against advocates of many gospels besides the four. In the second century, you see, there were actually several possibilities. The church could have opted for just one gospel. As one leader of a Christian sectarian group, Marcion, did, choosing Luke and carefully editing it to conform to his own teaching. Or the church could have adopted a gospel narrative created out of all four gospels, or perhaps also even more gospels, the various sources interwoven and absorbed into a kind of a composite gospel. Such a work, the Diatessaron of Tatian, was actually produced in the late second century, and it had some precursors probably. Now, either of those options could have been attractive because either of them would meet the problem of differences between the four gospels, which critics within and outside the church made much of during the second century. And thirdly, of course, more than four gospels could have been accepted as authentic, the option that some of the Gnostic groups took. So it wasn't necessarily at all obvious that the outcome of whatever processes of debate and discernment went on, that there should be a canon of precisely these four gospels. So how did the canon come about, the gospel canon? Now, I have to say first that we must admit there's a lot that we don't know. And I think the reason for that really is that the actual process of canonization, the discernment, the decisions about the status of various gospel writings, was primarily a grassroots process. It took place at the level of the local Christian communities. Some such process actually had to happen in local communities at a very early stage, because from an early stage in Christian worship, there were readings from the Old Testament scriptures and also from Christian writings, and no doubt often exposition of both. So any church had to decide which Christian writings were suitable for reading alongside the Old Testament, which must have meant pretty much scriptural status. And we can imagine a process by which a degree of consensus would have spread as one community heard what other communities were reading as scripture. An informal consensus would have grown up, at least about some groups, in some groups, though maybe not a complete consensus, but that's the kind of process that would have been happening as soon as there were four Gospels, not to speak of others, around. Now, there's one key question about the four Gospels in the second century that scholars have answered in two different ways. Was the four Gospel collection well established in the early part of the second century, prior to Marcion's insistence on one Gospel only, and prior to the widespread circulation of Gnostic Gospels? In that case, Marcion and the Gnostics represent challenges to which the mainstream church responded by defending and reaffirming the authority of the four Gospels and defining their status more firmly and exclusively as a gospel canon. Or should we think more in terms of a very fluid situation in the early and mid-second century in which many gospels were circulating and some more popular in different places from others? In that case, the fourfold gospel collection was a response by the mainstream church to Marcion and the Gnostics, who made mainstream Christians think for the first time of the need for a defined collection of reliable gospels. In other words, to put the issue very simply, did the four Gospels come before the Marcionite and Gnostic alternatives, or was the fourfold Gospel a reaction to the Marcionite and Gnostic alternatives? Scholars are divided. The latter has been a common view in 20th century scholarship and remains popular, but I think there are some signs of increasing support for the former view. Now, in my view, there's one very persuasive argument for that first view, the priority of the four gospel collection, that arises from the character of the gospels themselves, the four gospels and the Gnostic gospels, and the differences between the two. I mentioned before that the four gospels are biographical narratives, whereas most of the Gnostic gospels are post-resurrection revelations. Typically, in a Gnostic gospel, Jesus appears to the disciples after the resurrection, and either in a discussion with a group of disciples or in some special revelation to a favored disciple, Jesus imparts knowledge of the true nature of the world and salvation, the typically Gnostic message, characteristically depicted as an esoteric revelation that was not given in Jesus' public teaching during his ministry, but reserved for the elect few to whom he entrusts it afterwards. Now, I think that form of gospel, the post-resurrection revelation, actually presupposes that there were well-known accounts of the life and teaching of Jesus before his resurrection. Readers are certainly expected already to have some idea who Jesus and his disciples are. Some of these Gospels actually do not even name Jesus, but speak of him simply as the Saviour or the Lord. But more than that, the fact that they position themselves after the resurrection itself presupposes that definite accounts of Jesus' teaching during his ministry were well known. In other words, the purpose of the Gnostic Gospels is to add. Suppose there are well-known, well-established gospels of the narrative kind, and someone wanted to attribute to Jesus teaching of a different kind, teaching they wanted to present as the really important message of Jesus. How would one best do that? The narratives told by the four gospels actually offer an opportunity, because they speak of a period after the resurrection in which Jesus spent time with his disciples, but they offer few indications of what Jesus might have taught them in that period. The Gnostics were not the first or the only people to exploit that opportunity for filling out the gospel narratives with additional teaching given by Jesus after the resurrection. Now, the Gnostics did not, for the most part, simply ignore the teaching of Jesus as we find it in the four Gospels, but they thought it had hidden meanings that could only be elucidated in the light of the esoteric teaching of the post-resurrection period. Sometimes they imply that the writers of the narrative Gospels failed to understand what Jesus was talking about, and so they provided obscure accounts that needed interpretation and expansion by those who've received and understood the more profound teaching of the resurrected Lord. Sometimes they imply that the public teaching of Jesus could not be his real message, which was reserved for the Gnostic elect. In one way or another, they refer back to the teaching of the earthly Jesus, and sometimes they cite it explicitly in order to indicate what they see as its true interpretation. So they presuppose not just a fluid situation of oral Jesus traditions and many gospels, but a fixed body of teaching, which they attempt to augment with further teaching given by Jesus. They aim in a way to transcend the teaching of Jesus in the four Gospels by offering a qualitatively different kind of teaching, which Jesus reserved to the end, the best wine provided last. So in my view, the probability is that the four Gospels were widely known and valued already in the early second century, not too long after the writing of the last of them. This may not have been true everywhere. We must allow for some local variety. But the four Gospels must have been widely accepted as authoritative. Now, again, this didn't necessarily exclude the possibility of other Gospels also coming to be accepted, but the tendency would be for any other Gospel to be assessed by comparison with the four. The only way of, so to speak, trumping the four Gospels, of writing new Gospels with a different message, was to write a different sort of Gospel, the post-resurrection revelation. Now, if I'm right about that, that the four Gospels are not only chronologically prior, but also in some sense logically prior to the Gnostic Gospels, I think that's very important. It means that when it became necessary for the mainstream church to make decisions about which Gospels were authentic and which were not, they didn't start simply with a fluid and undifferentiated melee of Gospels, nor did they impose a purely doctrinal criterion for judging Gospels. Rather, they knew that at least the four Gospels had been around for a long time. The claims of those Gospels to be genuinely apostolic were pretty much undisputed. The issue was whether other Gospels were also apostolic. Now, from Irenaeus, and to some extent from a document from the late second century known as the Muratorian Canon, from these texts we can see that the principal criterion of Gospel canonicity used in the mainstream church was apostolicity. The elevation of these four Gospels into a canon, into an exclusive position, rested on the claim that all four of these Gospels are apostolic and that only these four are apostolic. Now, I'll explain in a moment what they meant by apostolic. But it's worth noticing first how that term served to guarantee the retention of the four Gospels as such, as well as to rule out others. It explains, you see, why the Gospel of Mark was retained, despite the fact that it seems to have been very little used in the second century, or indeed the following centuries. Because nearly all of Mark is also to be found in Matthew and Luke, it's easy to appreciate that people should have neglected Mark's gospel and preferred the more comprehensive gospels. But Mark's gospel was believed to derive quite closely from the testimony of Peter, and so it retained its place among the four gospels because it was known to be apostolic. The criterion of apostolicity also, I think, prevented the church opting for something like Tatian's diatessaron, a combination of the contents of all the Gospels woven together into a single narrative. This must have been an attractive option, but it was not taken because it was the four Gospels as such that were regarded as apostolic. The sense was doubtless that they came from the apostolic age and should not be superseded even by a new gospel compiled entirely from their contents. So what was meant by apostolicity as the criterion that Irenaeus and others used to distinguish between authentic and inauthentic gospel writings? I think there are three elements to it. First, there was an important chronological aspect. Apostolic gospels must derive from the apostolic age, which the fathers thought of as ending about 100, when the last of the four gospels, John's, was believed to have been written. So we find, for example, the Muratorian canon disqualifying from canonicity a work known as the Shepherd of Hermas, a book by an early Christian prophet. The author of the Muratorian text actually recommends the Shepherd of Hermas for reading. He regards it as orthodox and valuable, but he doesn't think it should be read publicly in church worship because of its post-apostolic date. Now, that's not a case of a gospel, but even more so would the issue of date of origin apply in the case of gospels. Secondly, apostolic gospels come from the circle of the apostles of Jesus. This narrows the criterion, not only from the apostolic period, but also from the circle of those whom Jesus himself gave the authority to preach the Christian message. The apostles were those who could be relied on to know what the true gospel was. Now, I've said from the circle of the apostles, because Irenaeus and others like him did not think that Mark and Luke were themselves apostles. But their gospels qualify because they were in close touch with apostles. So we needn't take apostolic authorship too strictly. It means, rather broadly, those who were really in a position to know what those who had been close to Jesus taught. And then thirdly, apostolicity implies conformity with the mainstream church's tradition of teaching. So even if one could not otherwise determine the historical origin of a gospel ascribed to Thomas or Mary, and of course the means of doing that were quite limited, one could still tell from its teaching whether it was authentically apostolic. Now this is the aspect of the matter that makes the four gospel canon seem to some contemporary scholars and others no more than an ideological act of privileging the literature of one group over others, the creation of an orthodoxy by imposing a narrow definition of the faith, But here it's important that the four Gospels were not suddenly given authority at this point, in my view, but had long been treated as authentically apostolic. The Church's established teaching, what Irenaeus calls the rule of faith, had always been closely related to the four Gospels and handed down along with them. These were the already accepted standards of apostolic teaching, and therefore it was quite reasonable to say that less well-authenticated gospels should be judged by the standards of the rule of faith and the four gospels. Let me pass to my fourth section, which is called Distinctive Characteristics of All Four Canonical Gospels. I want now to turn from how the four Gospels became canonical to the characteristics we can see for ourselves if we compare the canonical and the Gnostic Gospels. Many of us who study the Gospels get very used to delineating the differences between the four Gospels, especially between the Synoptics and John. But here I want to focus on what all four Gospels have in common by contrast with the Gnostic Gospels. And it's a question of perspective, I think. When we're focused on the New Testament Gospels, the differences can seem rather significant. But if we compare them with the other Gospels that were known in the second and third centuries, we can more easily see how much the four Gospels actually have in common. So I'll make four points about what the four Gospels have in common when we compare them with the Gnostic ones. First of all, as I've already said, in terms of their literary genre, the four Gospels are biographies. They offer a richly detailed portrayal of a real human life at a specific time and in a specific place. The Gnostic Gospels, on the other hand, none of which are biographies, most of which are post-resurrection revelations, lift Jesus out of the concrete specifics of such a narrative world into an almost purely mythical one. Jesus becomes a sheerly supernatural visitor to this world who reveals timeless truth. I've suggested that the Gnostic Gospels, in a sense, presuppose the narrative Gospels, but they do so by radically downgrading the narrative. Secondly, the four Gospels provide narratives that they closely connect with the Old Testament narrative of Israel. It's one of the most unmissable characteristics of the way the Gospels begin. Each of them in different ways, but each of them in some way portrays their own story as continuing the Old Testament story and recording the climax of the Old Testament story in Jesus and the events of the Gospel narratives. The Gnostic Gospels lack any such connection with the story of Israel. They never refer to fulfillment of prophecy, except the exception that proves the rule. In the Gospel of Thomas, the disciples say to Jesus that the prophets of Israel spoke of Jesus, and Jesus rebukes them for saying so. In most of the Gnostic Gospels, Jesus is never called Messiah or Christ, the title that in the New Testament is the most widespread of titles for Jesus, and of course connects Jesus with the hopes of Israel. Allusions to the Old Testament in the Gnostic Gospels are almost exclusively to the story of Adam. Now, we might maybe wonder whether all this is in the interest of universalizing the Christian message by disconnecting it from the particularity of Israel. And in a certain sense, that's true. But it's more a question, I think, of different kind of universalism in each case, the four Gospels and the Gnostic ones. The four Gospels follow the thrust of the story of Israel towards all the nations. The salvation they offer takes place for all people in the particular history of Israel and Jesus, but it does so for all people. The Gnostic Gospels, on the other hand, speak rather of the general human predicament in the world, and the salvation they offer is mythical rather than historical. Now, my third point, which is connected with that lack of connection with the Old Testament in the Gnostic Gospels. The third point is that the four Gospels are deeply rooted in Jewish monotheism. For them, there is one God, the creator of all things, the God of Israel and the God of Jesus. Now, this crucial question of the identity of God is the one that, in fact, Irenaeus focused on when he distinguished between the apostolic Gospels and those that contradict the apostolic faith, because the God of the Gnostic Gospels is certainly not the God of Israel. Now, that's the strongest reason why they disconnect Jesus from the story of Israel. In many of the Gnostic Gospels, we find a version of the common Gnostic myth, according to which the material world is the bungled work of an ill-intentioned and incompetent creator God, who is also the God of Israel. Whereas Jesus comes as the emissary of another, the Father, the high God, to whom the Gnostics truly belong. It's true that this myth is missing from some of the Gospels I've called Gnostic. And we can't now discuss whether it's implicitly taken for granted even in those works, such as the Gospel of Thomas, as I think. But even those Gospels that do not identify the God of Jesus, the God of Israel, with the creator of the world, even those Gospels that do not identify the God of Jesus with the creator of the world or the world, or with the God of Israel, they simply ignore the creator and Jewish God. Now, an interesting indication of this, I think, is worth noting, that in fact most of the Gnostic Gospels hardly ever use the word God at all, something that singles them out from most of the religious literature of their time, certainly from Jewish and Christian literature. In the four Gospels, the word God is common because they take for granted Jewish monotheism, and there's normally, therefore, no ambiguity about which God the word is referring to. The Gnostics, I think, are reluctant to call the true God, the God of Jesus, God, because among mainstream Christians, the word God refers to the wrong God, the Creator, and also because for them, divinity is really a quality shared by the many spiritual beings of their myth, including the Gnostics themselves. And fourthly, one aspect of the narrative character of all four Gospels is the embeddedness of the narrative in a historical context that can be verified. To the extent that the Jesus of these Gospels belongs to the world of Palestinian Judaism of the early first century, with its religious customs and rules, its factions and beliefs, its religious and political leaders, its uneasy subjection to Roman authority, and so forth, the four Gospels present a Jesus who is thoroughly credible within his time and place. Insofar as the Gnostic Gospels have anything of that kind at all, it's obviously derivative, derived from the narrative Gospels. It's vague or even blatantly erroneous. For example, the Mount of Olives located in Galilee. The Gnostic Gospels neither preserve real historical reference, nor were they at all interested in doing so. The fifth section is called the Gospels as Apostolic Testimony. This is the penultimate section. We've seen that apostolicity was the fundamental criterion the mainstream church used to define the canon of the four Gospels. But can we still regard the four Gospels as truly apostolic and contrast them in this respect with the other extant Gospels? Recall that the criterion of apostolicity for Irenaeus and others who argued this case did not have to entail actual apostolic authorship by an apostle, but required closeness to the apostles sufficient to enable faithful recounting of the traditions as they were told by the eyewitnesses of the events of Jesus' history. Now, in my recent book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, the Gospels as Eyewitness Testimony, I've argued that contrary to the view of the origins of the Gospels that has dominated much New Testament scholarship for the past century since the rise of form criticism, contrary to that dominant scholarly trend, I think there are good reasons to think that the Gospels as we have them are close to the way the eyewitnesses testified to what they had seen and participated in. There are no longer, I think, good reasons for supposing that gospel traditions pass through a lengthy process of oral transmission in which in the early Christian communities, independently of the eyewitnesses, before reaching the gospel writers. The standard pattern of thinking about this for the past century or so has been that the eyewitnesses may have started off the oral traditions, but then the oral traditions developed quite without reference to the eyewitnesses and were handed down anonymously within the Christian communities. Now, I think on the contrary, it's most plausible to think of the eyewitnesses as living and active, well known throughout the Christian movement down to the time when the Gospels were written. The eyewitnesses functioned as constantly accessible sources and authoritative guarantors of the traditions they themselves had formulated at the beginning of the movement. We need not think of the Gospels as far removed from their testimony, but rather as closely based on their testimony. Now, as I've already said, and probably most Gospel scholars now agree, the literary genre to which the Gospels, the four Gospels, belong is the ancient biography. And a little more precisely, I think we can say that they would have seemed to their first readers to be biographies that were fairly close to the conventions and methods of ancient history writing. The ancients had strong views about how history should be written. It must be based on eyewitness testimony. The good historian should either have been an eyewitness himself, or he should have met and been able to interview people who were eyewitnesses. Good historical writing should incorporate the accounts of eyewitnesses at first or second hand. And this is why the ancients thought that real history had to be contemporary history. It had to be written when eyewitnesses were still available. Now, the chronology of gospel writing is, I think, important here. The four gospels, almost everyone agrees, the four gospels were written within living memory of the events. They're contemporary history, and they would have been seen as such. It's surely significant that Matthew, Luke, and John, probably written at the very end of the period in which this could still be true. The chronological aspect of apostolicity, as the mainstream church later understood it, actually makes very good sense in the light of ancient historiography. What we have then in the four Gospels, in my view, is good access to the apostolic testimony about Jesus. I want to stress that term testimony. The eyewitnesses from whom the Gospels derive were not disinterested observers. They were involved participants in the events they later recalled and narrated. They were committed believers in the Jesus whose story they told. They and the Gospel writers were thoughtful interpreters of the significance that story had for human salvation. As I've noticed already, very briefly, they interpreted that significance very differently from the way the Gnostic Gospels do. But let me just make two further points I think are important about this apostolic testimony, as I call it. First, as we've seen, history matters to this testimony, as it does not for the Gnostic Gospels. It matters for the apostolic testimony that Jesus was a real participant in real history, and therefore it matters that the accounts are well based on the way the eyewitnesses told the story. The history is interpreted, of course, but it is history that's interpreted. Secondly, the testimony of the eyewitnesses was in fact the kind of testimony that was valued by ancient historians, that of involved participants, people who could convey something of the reality of the events from the inside. It's the kind of testimony we need if we're to grasp anything of the meaning of events as exceptional as those of which the four Gospels tell. We cannot and we don't have to polarize fact and meaning. The four Gospels give us at the same time both the most reliable access to what happened in the history of Jesus and also the meaning that those who were closest to Jesus perceived in those events, which they found to be life-changing revelation of God. It's that inseparable combination of fact and meaning, history and interpretation, that we have in the four Gospels that qualifies them for the authority these Gospels came to have for the mainstream church. Appropriately, they came to be seen as both the best access we have to the history of Jesus and also the normative understanding of the significance of that history for Christian faith. So I come to my last point, which is called the authority of the four Gospels as canonical. For the mainstream church that canonized the four Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels preached a different Jesus, a Jesus not rooted in first century history, a Jesus not related to the story of Israel, a Jesus who did not come from the one God, the creator of all things. I think that verdict on the Gnostic Gospels is indisputably correct. Very profound religious differences were at stake, and the mainstream church's decision for the four Gospels alone was momentous for the character of Christian faith down the centuries since. We should note carefully again that the church did not reduce the plurality of the Gospels to only one. In a way, I think it's as significant for the character of subsequent Christian faith that the church accepted no less than four, as well as no more than four. The church did receive four different perspectives on Jesus, but defined, as it were, only a limited plurality. As we've seen, the four Gospels, for all their differences, look significantly similar when we place them alongside the very different Gospels that were not accepted. One major reason why there is currently so much interest in other Gospels is undoubtedly a postmodern cultural climate in which it seems liberating to break out of the restrictive canon of the traditional church and to recognize the great variety of interpretations of Jesus and Christian faith that were once available before the mainstream church imposed orthodox uniformity. Recognizing this variety in the ancient Christian world suits an agenda of radical pluralism in the contemporary Christian world. All sorts of interpretations of Jesus are legitimate. Any dream will do. Any notion of normative gospels, any notion of authoritative norms of faith is restrictive and oppressive. I guess the question comes down to, is there a real Jesus? A Jesus who lived in first century Palestine, as well as being alive and accessible to believers today? And does it matter what sort of God this Jesus revealed? If the answers are yes, then I think we have to face the same unavoidable decision that the early church had to make between the Jesus of the four Gospels and his God, and the very different Jesus of the Gnostic Gospels and his God. Thank you.
Copyright 2007, Westminster Seminary, California. All rights reserved. You are permitted to reproduce and distribute this material in any format, provided that you do not alter the wording in any way, and you do not charge a fee beyond the cost of reproduction. For web posting, a link to this broadcast on our website is preferred.